Thanks for joining us here in our studios on K Street in Washington, D.C. This is American Dream. I'm Elliot Francis. Well, the Annapolis Peace Conference is just less than a month old, and some are already reporting flaws in the armor of this latest peace process. Many, of course, are also wondering just what is different about this latest peace initiative. Will it work? Won't it? And why? Joining us for our discussion this afternoon, three distinguished guests from here in the area. First, to my extreme right, James Phillips. Mr. Phillips is a senior fellow of the Heritage Foundation. Beside James, Khalil Jashan. Khalil is the executive director for the D.C. internship program at Pepperdine University. And beside him, Edward Peck. Ambassador Peck is former U.S. ambassador to Iraq. We thank you all for joining us here on American Dream this afternoon.
Sure.
One by one, you all were certainly observers of the peace conference less than a month ago. I want to get your general assessment of what went on there. Again, it's just the beginning of the process, but what do you think was accomplished or not accomplished in general from just that peace conference on that one day? Ambassador Peck?
Well, okay, since you've asked me for my views, I think that the basic flaw, my perspective, the basic flaw is to call it a peace conference because it isn't peace that you're looking for there. It's the end of an occupation. So if you're talking about peace, you're talking about something that is totally disassociated from the fact that one country is occupied and suppressed and the people in their own homeland are looking for an end to the occupation. You've got peace in the West Bank if you've been there. What you don't have is international law, freedom, justice, or hope. That's what's lacking. Peace you've got.
Mm-hmm. But looking to end that occupation is what you think.
Yes, sir. That's if you talk about that, then the nature of the problem comes into focus.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about bringing about peace, that's a whole different objective.
It requires the president to be directly and fully involved.
Khalil, your take.
I think it was a glorified photo op, basically, that we witnessed at Annapolis. Certainly, the Secretary of State deserves credit for convening 50 people and different international organizations that usually would not be easy to kind of convene together. But beyond that, frankly, the flaws of Annapolis started, you know, we didn't have to go 3-4 weeks to realize that there were flaws. In the sense that, unlike previous attempts, number one, there was no preparation. In the past, when the U.S. was involved in peacemaking in the Middle East, it took us maybe a year or two to put a team together, to put some ideas together, to put some bridging of gaps, proposals together, to talk or pre-negotiate with the parties. Mm-hmm. But this time, we didn't do any of that. Therefore, it's very difficult for me to be optimistic about this process, and my views haven't changed. Before the conference was put together, during the conference, or after the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, what you referred to in your introduction, that there we are 3 weeks later and people are having second thoughts, second thoughts are justified.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Phillips, I suspect you have a different take on this.
Well, I would say the Annapolis conference was important because it was an attempt by a broad array of countries to breathe life into the comatose peace negotiations. I'm not optimistic that it's going to go that far, in part because I don't think the conditions are ripe for a final settlement at this point. Both the chief negotiating governments on the Israeli and the Palestinian side are relatively weak and divided, and Hamas is in a position to block any progress towards peace.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Israeli side, Prime Minister Olmert can't deliver on an agreement that he signed. His own coalition government would disintegrate. And then going to the question of occupation, I would say that, you know, the occupation of Gaza ended, but there's no peace there. So it's not just a question of occupation. I think there needs to be some kind of negotiations between the sides and with the broader Arab world if there's going to be a final settlement.
You, in fact, wrote shortly before that you thought the prospects for success were cloudy. So you're still coming out of it on the other side of that. It seems like you still think so.
I still think so, because originally I think Annapolis was envisioned by the administration as an international forum for approving an agreement between the Palestinians and Israelis, but over time it was downgraded. It was supposed to breathe life into Secretary of State's Condoleezza Rice's vision of a political horizon, but when the two sides sat down, they had tremendous difficulties in hammering out a joint document for a common vision. And I think towards the end, the administration realized that it would have to be just the beginning of a very long process rather than a formal summit.
Mm-hmm. There are those that would say that at the end of this, we came out with an agreement on both sides for the two-state solution. And there are folks that are really waving the flag on this one. I see Ambassador Peck shaking his head now.
I don't think that was anything. You know, the two-state solution is something that's been talked about a lot. Mr. Phillips, I know that you talked about the two governments being relatively weak. And I think trying to compare the Palestinians with the Israelis in terms of a weak government overlooks the word that I threw into the conversation early. It's an occupied country. You know, to me, as an outsider, as an American, when we talk about Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, I find that terribly misleading, because when the democratically elected leader of the Palestinian prisoners meets with the jailers to discuss improvements of life inside the prison, that is not a negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
We talk very openly about Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's not a conflict. The conflict is between two states that have territories and armies to defend them. The Palestinians have none of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an occupation, pure and simple, and the government of Mr. Olmert, which may be weak relatively, has its heel on the neck of the Palestinians, who have nothing, especially freedom.
Weak in what sense?
Weak? Well, I mean, try it this way. If the American army, if our army, with all its enormous resources, has difficulty controlling Iraq, which we occupy,
mm-hmm.
how do you expect the Palestinians, who have pistols and whistles, in an area where they're not allowed to move freely through the barbed wire and the checkpoints, to control dissidents in that situation? I mean, it seems like an unequal contest.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about Gaza is no longer occupied, well, it depends how you want to define occupation. Israel controls the seacoast, the borders, the airspace, and the land. Now, if that's withdrawal, then we're using words that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Khalil, sounds like you want to jump in here.
Well, the problem in assessing Annapolis is the fact that so many people, including analysts who should know better, keep referring to it as a negotiating process. It wasn't a negotiating process. It hasn't yet started. It was meant to be a launching ground for a negotiating process that we haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
I am supportive of a negotiated settlement. Personally, I've been for many, many years. I'd rather see people sit down and talk rather than shoot at each other. Mm-hmm. But peace processes, if we have learned anything as observers of the Middle East for the last 20, 30 or more years, we've learned that a peace process is not born in a vacuum. It needs some tilling of the ground. It needs some preparation. It needs some, basically, you need to set it up for success. And in this case, we lowered the ceiling so low in terms of, initially we talked about a negotiating process, we called it a conference, then we called it just a meeting, and you know, we kept lowering the level to the point where the bar has been lowered so low that even the most nimble dancer from Trinidad couldn't make it under the bar, you know. Mm-hmm. So what is it that we want? There is confusion. Are we ending occupation? Are we really looking for a two-state solution? When you corner the president or the secretary of state with a question like that, the answer is always vague. We leave it up to the parties. But you're talking about the establishment of the state. Supposedly, the president is very proud to be the first, and he deserves credit for being the first president ever to enter the word Palestine into the American political dictionary. And he keeps reminding those of us every time you meet with him or with the secretary of state that we need to be more forthcoming in praising him for being the first president to advocate the creation of a Palestinian state. God bless him. We want a Palestinian state to emerge in the region. But a Palestinian state is not born in a vacuum. You need to do your homework. We've seen that before. The Middle East has been a cemetery for proposals of good intentions since 1937. Mm-hmm. This is the 77th attempt at peacemaking in the Middle East since the first partition plan of 1937. Mm-hmm. So some of us who are students of this region are not impressed by good intentions. You need to do your homework before you embark in a process of this magnitude, and before you raise expectations in the region and then let those expectations go down to hell and then start asking the questions, why do they hate us and why they are mad?
Mm-hmm. I see heads shaking back and forth. Agree? Disagree, gentlemen?
Well, I would agree. I'd take a slightly different slant. I think for American presidents, Arab-Israeli peace has been kind of the holy grail, especially for a president in his last year of office. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me was that it seemed like President Bush stepped back a little at the conference. I mean, he came for a few hours, and then he hosted meetings at the White House. But you get the impression that this is more Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's baby, so to speak, that it's her diplomatic offensive here, and it's by no means clear that President Bush is willing to do to knock heads, so to speak, mm-hmm. to reach very hard agreement.
Some have even argued that it from the Bush administration's standpoint, just a superficial attempt at trying to gain an ulterior motive. I mean, somebody pointed out today, he's had 7 years in office to do this.
I think it's a justified comment in the sense that this is an administration that for 7 years has had a policy of benign neglect. As a matter of fact, some people do not think it was benign, and ignored this issue of vital interest to the United States in an area that is of vital interest to the United States, mm-hmm. for all kinds of reasons, most of which are still vague. But the president, since the first day he came in office, even though he talked about his vision for the region several years ago, but he never really turned that or translated that into an active policy that his administration became known for. Mm-hmm. And so talking about a Palestinian state, talking about, is easy. But getting the parties together and translating that into a political process, which requires James knows, he's been observing the region for many years, it's not enough for the president to walk into a conference of this magnitude for a few hours and go home. If, all the peace, it has been a national, peacemaking in the Middle East has been a national sport for this country, okay? Mm. We've been involved in it since 1947. Almost every president, as James alluded to, has been involved in this. We tend to avoid it first year in office, last year in office, for political, domestic political reasons. But every administration has had its share of peacemaking in the Middle East. And we have learned one thing in doing that over the past 50-plus years, 58 years, is the fact that short of serious involvement at the highest levels of the U.S. government, including the person of the President of the United States, it's nonsense. You can't call this my Secretary of State pet project, with all due respect to Secretary Rice, and I totally respect and understand her personal commitment. She has talked about that in private and in public over the years, and her efforts should be appreciated, but that's not enough. If the president is not behind this effort 100% and is not willing to dedicate, and this is a high-maintenance conflict that requires the president to be directly and fully involved in this process, otherwise we're wasting our time.
I think you're right, because the Secretary of State does not make American foreign policy. She's the mouthpiece, not, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. She's the person who explains it, but the one who drives it, the one who makes the decisions, the decider, is the President of the United States. So you can send her out to die, and flail and thrash around, but she doesn't carry the weight unless that man is either directly behind her or, even better, in front of her.
I mean, already it seems to be going south.
It's been done before. Israel recognizing the machinery that's involved, every time they come to a conference like this, immediately upon returning, they do something that indicates that they don't really mean it. I remember Secretary Baker said that always, just before he arrived on a visit, they did something that made it perfectly clear that they weren't tremendously concerned about anything he was going to say or do, mm-hmm. under the first Bush administration. But every nation has the right to do what it conceives to be in its best interests. I don't deny that to anybody. They can be dead wrong, But still, every nation has the right, they're sovereign nations, to do whatever they think is in their best interests. Mm-hmm. My problem has always been that we are deeply concerned about Israel's best interests, and Israel is deeply concerned about Israel's interests. And I think that that is an unfair arrangement, an unequal arrangement, because we should be concerned equally, or perhaps even more, about our own interests. And I don't see that in the Middle East, especially in the case of Israel and Palestine.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you referred to a very important point there in terms of some of the events that are intruding right now on, yeah. on this emerging or newly kind of launched process. I'm not impressed by events immediately after a process is launched. The reason for that is, again, there is a whole history, like I said, of probably 60, 70 years of peacemaking in the Middle East, even that predates the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 by about 11 years. But beyond that, you expect the parties to be jockeying for position, okay? And let's give Israel the benefit of the doubt. It's the stronger party. It's creating facts on the ground. It has done that every time. But what is missing is a decisive management of the process right now. And that's why these things kind of could and most probably would get out of control. You referred to James Baker, who was probably, I would say, the most experienced and most intelligent of secretaries of state to delve into this process, and that's why it came close to achieving something over the 90s, okay? But he used to say something very interesting to the parties early on in the Madrid period. He used to say, if this endeavor is to succeed, I guess being a farmer, he used to use a lot of Western terminology. We had to gather all the parties into the middle of the corral and raise the fence so high to make sure that none of the parties would scale the fence. And if any one party would dare to scale the fence, we need to go after it with a 2x4. And right now, we do not have a 2x4 to ensure the success of this process. So you can't you can't simply declare that you are the sole legitimate peacemaker in the Middle East and not allow anybody else to share in the leadership of this process when you are so biased, as the ambassador said, and when you lack the tools to set this process up for success. Thus far, we have set it up for failure.
Mm. I'm afraid you're right. And I hope I'm wrong.
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And interesting you should say that, because there are those who will take those comments and certainly the observation that President Bush needs to be engaged more, and if he's not, why? There are those who would say, well, there you go. I told you this is all just a red herring. You see some of the people that are some of the states that were brought together. He's trying to line up support in this ongoing conflict that we have with Iran.
There are some serious questions about the motives, okay? Mm-hmm. For example, why, after ignoring this conflict for 7 years, all of a sudden the administration has discovered the truth that mm-hmm. somehow this conflict is at the center of instability in the region and we need to focus on it? There is no doubt in my mind that the conflict between Washington and Tehran at this time has prompted the administration to basically look for ways and means, for alliances, if you will, within the region to counter the spread of Iranian influence in the region. Now, some people say it's probably trying to rally forces to attack Iran. I doubt it, personally. I don't think we are in shape mm-hmm. right now to be attacking. But I don't know. I might be wrong in this respect. Some people think that, you know, we could do that, particularly in a desperate situation in Iraq toward the end of an administration, that the administration might embark on an adventure, an unwise adventure as this one, out of weakness. But I personally doubt it. Mm-hmm. But at least there is no doubt that there has been concern, and the President and the Secretary of State have made it very clear. If you read carefully their speeches and if you read between the lines, the fact that the region is under the influence of quote-unquote, we call them sometimes terrorists, because any opposition to U.S. policy, sometimes it's called terroristic, which mm-hmm. is not necessarily an accurate depiction. But that opposition led by Iran is bugging the administration, is making the administration uncomfortable. If we were to solve this problem, somehow, I think you probably will win a good chunk of the players in the region to embark on kind of a different ball game with you, but not necessarily attacking Iran.
Mm-hmm. James, let me get James Phillips in here for a second.
I would just say that Iran comes in in another way, too, that it could influence the thinking of many Arab states who may realize that they have more of a threat coming from Iran than from an Israel that at some point is willing to sign an agreement and make peace, and that perhaps the administration is reacting to pressure from some of its Arab allies, particularly Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to push forward at this point. Mm-hmm. But I would just say that while presidential involvement is necessary, it's not sufficient, and that, you know, as we saw with President Clinton in Camp David and in previous administrations, that the conditions on the ground have to be ready for peace, and I'm very pessimistic that they are at this point. So it's not just a question of the U.S. getting involved. I think that, you know, when you have more than half the Palestinian territory and or its population controlled by an organization that not only is against peace with Israel but wants to destroy Israel, then it's very difficult to get Israel to negotiate on final status issues, especially if any territory it gives up will only be used to launch rockets against it. From.
And many might have said right from the very beginning, the exclusion of Hamas was just, just looking for trouble.
Well, I had the good fortune of being in Gaza in January of 06 as an international election observer. And I was struck by a number of factors. One was that Fatah, which had been in power for all those decades, organized the election, the polling places, the ballots, the collection, the counting, the security, and they said, we lost. Mm. Now, this was compelling to me. The difference between, one of the many significant differences between a dictatorship and a democracy is that you can have an election in a dictatorship, but everybody knows exactly how it's going to come out. And in a democracy, you can lose. So having pushed and pushed and pushed for democratic, free and fair elections, and in Palestine you had them, and then America says, no, sorry, you chose the wrong people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a thing there. The Palestinians, bless them, would like to be free. Isn't that something that people push for? And they're not free. And I spoke with Haniyeh, who is the head guy of Hamas, and he said, how can you ask us to recognize a country when we don't know where the borders are? Where are the borders of Israel? That's what you recognize is a piece of land. Where is it? Is it all the way into the Ariel Finger? Is it Har Homa? Where are the borders? How do we recognize this place when they haven't yet told us where it is? Mm-hmm. And have they recognized Palestine? I mean, this is called reciprocity.
Sure.
I'm a diplomat, I'm sorry. You know, so okay. This is called, we recognize you, you recognize us, but there isn't any dual recognition here. So that, to me, the struggle has been so shatteringly unequal because the poor Palestinians have nothing living in their little ghettos, mm-hmm, with the barbed wire and the settlements and the checkpoints. The obstacle is what? There's 580 movement obstacles in the West Bank. And it's a shattering, depressing thing to go there and to recognize that after all these years, the Palestinians are missing one terribly important ingredient for any success. It's called hope. Mm. They see nothing that gives them any sign, even a tunnel, let alone a light at the end of it.
We'll have more American Dream right after this. And welcome back to American Dream. I'm Elliot Francis. Of course, we're talking about the Annapolis Peace Conference and the forthcoming Mideast Peace Talks and the initiative. We're joined by our guest, James Phillips from the Heritage Foundation, Khalil Jashan from Pepperdine University, and, of course, former ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck, Ambassador Peck. You were just talking in the break. I wanted to talk about some of the policies that have put up the walls, so to speak, that we're trying to knock down.
Well, the press, certainly the liberal press, has made a lot about the fact that we have lost measurable amounts, discernible amounts of our national, international standing as a result of events in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And it's always been a source of great interest to me that people need to understand that if you're trying to market a product, which in this case is democracy, you have to spend a little bit of time trying to consider what it is that the potential customer wants and is interested in. Now, you don't need to do that, but if you don't do that, then you're going to have a hard time selling the product. So in the case of the Middle East, where we keep talking about democracy and democracy, from their perspectives, and it doesn't mean that they're right necessarily, but their perception is that the two active democracies in the Middle East, Israel and the United States, are trying to spread democracy by the use of handguns. Mm. And by definition, you cannot impose democracy. Democracy implies a choice. That's what it's all about. And you can't force people to be democratic, but by George, we're going to try. Mm-hmm. And the only demonstrations that they have seen of democracy in action in the Middle East is the occupation and subjugation of Palestine and the occupation and subjugation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And that is not a great marketing tool, I don't think.
Yeah. Your reaction?
I think this whole issue of the diminished credibility of the United States, particularly when we embark on a major project of bringing about peace to a protracted conflict that has escaped solutions for more than 58 years, is a very important one. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a strange situation, frankly, as a student of history and student particularly of the Middle East. This is a very weird situation, to say the least, in the sense that we are being called upon to mediate a conflict in which we are a party. That doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good point.
Most of the time, when two parties have a conflict, they go to a neutral party to mediate it. We have taken sides in the Arab-Israeli conflict long time ago, and we do not hide it. But again, because of relationship, particularly with the one side we have chosen to side with, Israel, the other side, out of weakness, feels that we're the only one that can impress upon Israel to come to the table. And that is reflective more of the weakness on the Arab side and the Palestinian side included, rather than on the strength of the American side. And we, as a mediator or as a country that keeps claiming that we are the sole gateway into peace in the Middle East, we have not accounted for this factor.
That's a very interesting point. And considering in past years we... And you're right. In all situations of mediation like that, you usually have one independent person who sits and sort of judges and takes it all in. In past years, we may have had that equity, but as you stated, we don't anymore. Let's dream for a second. Who would be that mediator? Who could be that mediator?
Well, ideally, first of all, I mean, it's a fact that mm-hmm. we are a superpower with hegemony almost on the region. Mm-hmm. Our relationship with Israel gives us the upper hand in the region. The weakness on the Arab side and the dependence of 90% of Arab regimes for their own survival and security on their bilateral relations with us gives us great power mm-hmm. In the region and great power that shows up at the negotiating table in these types of processes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily the way to proceed. When I mean that we have failed to account for that bias in the past, that means basically we need to re-examine or reassess our position. Let's say, for example, our claim that we are the sole kind of legitimate peacemaker in the Middle East. We have refused the UN a constructive role. We have refused the Soviet Union in the old days and now Russia an equal role. We have refused the EU, which is a partner in so many different parts of the world. We trust them in negotiating with Iran. We trust them in negotiating with North Korea, but we do not trust them in negotiating with Israel or negotiating with the peace process. We need to balance our act somehow.
James, let me ask you, are we the right country? Are we the right person to be in the middle of all this, or should it be someone else? And even a larger question, which I was going to ask too, are all the leaders who are involved in this, Abbas, Olmert, are these the right players for this kind of kind of act?
Yeah, I would say for the second question, I cannot see Prime Minister Olmert or President Abbas being in a position to finally resolve this conflict, because both have their own political problems at home with a divided constituency, mm-hmm. to say the least. Yeah. But secondly, I would say that the U.S. has credibility with both sides, unlike other parties, but the Bush credibility suffered recently with the war in Iraq. But I think the Bush administration has tried to finesse this by bringing in the quartet. But from my point of view, too many cooks spoil the broth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, The ambassador was talking about Secretary of State Baker, who convened the Madrid conference, which turned into, you know, kind of bogged down very quickly. It was a very nice ceremonial conference, but the real heavy lifting and negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians occurred in Oslo in secret bilateral negotiations. And I think if there's going to be hope for the future, it will come in secret bilateral negotiations, not in some big open process where every country in the world is involved for ceremonial purposes.
Mm-hmm. The people who negotiated in Oslo, as I remember, I defer to both you gentlemen, they were not officials of the Israeli government. They were members of Israel who were peaceniks and who talked with Palestinians, but they did not come out as an official. It was all done in secret and quiet, and it was kind of sprung on the Israeli government afterwards. Is that a fair assessment?
It was a mixed group of both officials and private sector people, academicians and experts on the region. So it was a combination, but it received basically a green light from both sides to go ahead and negotiate in light of the fact that at the time, the 10 rounds of negotiations that you and I are familiar with, all of us are familiar with, that took place here in D.C., failed. So they took the other alternative to see if that would kind of break the ice. And frankly, the expectations were, I mean, judging from my own meetings with Israeli leaders, including the prime minister at the time, he was not hopeful. I had met with Israeli leaders just a week before the agreement was reached. They were not very hopeful at all that they would work, and it surprised them, which brings me to the point that Jim brought up, and would like to comment on it, is are these the right leaders? Well, yes and no. They are the right leaders by virtue of the fact that they have been elected rightly or wrongly, whatever, it doesn't matter how you look at it, mm-hmm. by their own people. So they have a constituency in Israel and Palestine that they represent. Who else are you going to have to represent Israel at the negotiating table and the Palestinians at the negotiating table, mm-hmm. other than the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of Palestine? But at the same time, the reference is really stems out of their weakness. People keep saying this is the weakest prime minister in Israel's modern history. His popularity at one point was less than the margin of error in these public opinion polls, reached single digits, like 5-6%. Abu Mazen's popularity on the Palestinian side is, in the 20s. Our own president is too weak. Mm-hmm. But look, sometimes weakness is an opportunity. And we've tried strong leaders, by the way, on both sides, and they didn't deliver in the past. Mm-hmm. Let's try weak ones and see if they deliver. As my friend, the Palestinian ambassador here in Washington, D.C., recently said to comment on the fact that nothing could be expected from President Bush because he's a lame duck, he said, well, even a lame duck can lay eggs.
Good
if it's
point.
A female, yes. talk to
me as we talk about this. This issue of leaders and all the players in this process, it seems to me that you can't exclude Hamas, and it feels like just that is happening.
Right? You can't exclude Hamas because of the reason that the ambassador said, as an observer of the elections. This was I'm not a fan of Hamas, by the way, mm-hmm. but these were democratic elections,
yeah.
certified too by the world community, including a huge American delegation that included a former president of the United States. And now, is it to our liking that Hamas? It wasn't to my liking. It wasn't to the liking of many people. But you cannot simply go and negate the will of a people when you have been preaching democracy to the region, sure. and preaching democracy particularly to that people. And when democracy takes its course and the result is not to our liking, so we decide to totally deny it or neglect it, you know, and say, well, this is not a partner. We're not going to sit down with them and talk with them. Instead of sitting with them, challenging them, mm-hmm. explaining to them the disagreements we have with them. And they did not run on a foreign policy platform. They ran on a domestic platform. The Palestinian people did not vote for them. The Palestinian people today, when you say, like, Abu Mazen is weak, I agree, Abu Mazen is weak. But Abu Mazen's strength is the fact, Abbas's strength is the fact that 60% of the Palestinian people today keep saying that a negotiated settlement is our preference. Olmert is weak. Yes, he is. But 59% of the Israeli public say, now, if Abbas and Olmert are smart enough and effective enough as political leaders, they will tap into that resource and lead it and overcome the difficulties that they have and the criticism that they have. But that remains to be seen.
Who are we to deny the will of the people? As I say, both of you are shaking your heads. I'll let you get it.
Go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
I would just pick up on what you said about even a lame duck can lay eggs. I think we need to lower our expectations and hopes and not to reach an agreement in the last year of the Bush administration, but to reach a process that could survive into the next administration and maybe the next leaders on the Palestinian and the Israeli side, that they can consolidate public support for a lasting and sustainable peace. Because I don't think it's realistic to expect a permanent status agreement to be reached by the end of this administration.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with Jim. I mean, the expectation of a 1 year is totally unrealistic. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, many people say that one.
And of course, part of the problem that we're talking around is that the American people who are perhaps the not the world's most intensely interested in what's going on in the rest of the world, not very well informed. Certainly in the case of the Middle East, I think the non-existent lobby is very effective in ensuring that the news that the Americans get is tailored to what is acceptable to the non-existent lobby. I offer as an example, there was a reference made to Camp David, where if you remember, Mr. Olmert tabled the final agreement. This was it. This was the end of it all. He was the prime minister. Barak tabled the final arrangement, and he presented it to Yasser Arafat in the presence of President Clinton, and he, Arafat, walked away. Mm-hmm. And the American people, I ask in my presentations, how many of you think that he passed up a great opportunity for a Palestinian state? And he got all these hands. I said, now, would you put your hands up again if you came to that conclusion after having carefully studied a map of what he was offered?
Nothing.
No American newspaper showed you a map. So then how do you know how good the deal was? President Clinton told you. And the Prime Minister of Palestine, of Israel, told you. But if you look at the map and what he was supposed to get, 16 little Bantustans surrounded by checkpoints and barbed wire and separated by settlements and all. That's a state?
Yeah.
Please. But people were told it was great and they thought it was great and nobody ever showed them the travesty that was being presented as the final solution.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. And this goes on a fair bit. So now when the press is talking about the new settlements at Har Homa, I don't know what the Americans visualize when you talk about an Israeli settlement. Have you been in the West Bank, Jim, at all?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Beverly Hills. That's with the swimming pools and the sports centers and they're not leaving.
Yeah.
They're staying.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Forever.
What makes it difficult, Elliot, is the fact that this is supposedly a process that we're supposed to embark on that is based on the concept of exchanging land for peace. And if the first half of the formula ain't there, you know, if there is no land to exchange for peace, how do we expect them to achieve peace? Mm-hmm. So and that's what I think our policy has missed over the years. Yes, the Secretary of State this week made some representation to the Israeli government over this newly announced expansion after Annapolis of Har Homa. Frankly, to just keep making these polite representation, we've been making them for more than 30 years when we had 20,000 settlers, and now we have 500,000 settlers mm-hmm. between West Bank settlements and Jerusalem Jewish neighborhoods, both of which are illegal according to international law, and nothing has happened. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a much more forceful position on an issue that presidents of the United States used to call illegal only 20 years ago, and now they are so timid, I think they call it a boo-boo right now, I don't know. They're afraid to say it's illegal, they're afraid to say it's unhelpful, they're afraid to say, and that what rubs our policy of credibility in the region.
Yeah.
But the problem that both of you gentlemen referred to quite accurately in terms of the political issues domestically facing both the Israelis and the Palestinians, it also applies here, because President Bush is unable to, or any other president, to rally a majority of the American people to become actively informed on and involved in and concerned over the ending of the occupation. I don't like to use the word peace because the Americans, A, don't know, B, don't really care all that much, and they are being steadily fed a diet of partial information, mm-hmm. some of which, of course, is also misleading.
Mm-hmm. And the elections is a case in point. I mean, right now, none of the candidates would go out of their way to endorse a two-state solution or to endorse renewed peace efforts in the Middle East. Why? Because of their false assumption that if they do so, they will lose votes and they will lose money. Yep. And Zogby poll just this week came out with in Iowa and in New Hampshire, where basically support for a two-state solution on both sides, Republican and Democrat, mm-hmm. is in the vicinity of 50 to 60%. So on the contrary, you could gain votes by appealing to that segment of American society that's in support of it. And yet, the courage is not there.
In the time we have left, gentlemen, give me an assessment. Where do we go from here? What do you think the best direction for all these players is to go and to get something useful out of this down the line? James?
Well, I would just go back to the idea of planting eggs, not to rush to failure, to follow up Annapolis with very carefully prepared diplomatic efforts, and not expect them to result in some kind of a peace agreement in the next year of the Bush administration, but to lay the seeds for future progress, to build trust between the sides, to increase the security of both sides, and perhaps down the road there may be a future two-state Arab-Israeli peace agreement.
Okay. I agree with James that we shouldn't rush to failure, and that's what I meant earlier in the conversation when I said this whole process should be structured for success rather than for failure. But again, based on the 76 previous attempts at peacemaking in the Middle East, I believe that there has to be a horizon. It can't be an open-ended thing. As the ambassador said earlier, we need to talk even much more forcefully about the objective. The objective of this enterprise is to create that Palestinian state alongside Israel, living in harmony and peace with that state. And in addition to the horizon, so that people can see that hope that the ambassador accurately mentioned is missing right now, particularly on the Palestinian side, but not exclusively on the Palestinian side, because hope is missing on the part of many Israelis too. There has to also be a timetable. There has to be a timeline. This is not an open-ending process. We shouldn't rush to failure, but there has to be some reasonable. Because, what ensures? We had a process when Clinton left office. Then we had a president who came in and decided to wash his hands off mm-hmm. and play his fiddle like Nero for 7 years. All of a sudden now he wants to come back. So it is going to take more than 1 year. Most probably the next administration will be involved in. We are not the type that can pass. Our system doesn't allow for a project in foreign policy to be passed from one administration to the other. But if we are embarked on a serious one, I hope that the next administration will responsibly follow in the footsteps of what has been achieved.
Ambassador, we have about a minute.
I'm a thinking optimist. Mm-hmm. A thinking optimist comes out looking like a pessimist. I remember when Mr. Sharon visited President Bush, and Mr. Bush gave him a letter that said, "You may keep the settlements." And he used the phrase in that letter, as I recall it, "Given the facts on the ground, you get to keep those settlements." Now, this, we have always pushed for bilateral negotiations. And when you make a step like that, anybody on the Palestinian side says, "What? What was our role in this?" Mm-hmm. And they're still building them. So when you talk about building trust, trust is destroyed when you build settlements and checkpoints and run up more barbed wire and build walls. Mm-hmm. They call it a separation wall, and I would like to ask everybody listening if they know how to say separation in Afrikaans. Mm. It's called apartheid. And President Carter used that word in his book and has been vilified. That is a separation wall, and apartheid is separation, and separation is apartheid. Mm. And I don't see any hope at all myself, and I am an optimist. Mm-hmm. I work for it. I wish for it. I don't see it as a prayer.
Interesting point to end on. We do have to end it there. Gentlemen, great conversation, very stimulating ideas. Thank you all for coming in today. James Phillips from the Heritage Foundation, Khalil Jashan from Pepperdine University, of course, former ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck.
Sure.
Thank you all for coming down and joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Hope to see you again soon. And thank you for joining us here on our studios, K Street, Washington, D.C., for American Dream. I'm Elliot Francis. Hope to see you again soon.